Sunday morning, May the 12th, on the Bible alleged contradictions. Again, your comments and thoughts will be appreciated on this study. If you have some thoughts on what we're discussing, I also remind you, if you think I make a misapplication of a verse, please bring that to my attention that it can be corrected on that. We left off last week, and you probably don't have this on the top of your sheet, does God ever sleep? And we looked at Psalms chapter 121 and verse 4 concerning that God never does not sleep. Someone that had it, Psalms 121 verse 4, read that please. Marilyn, if you have it. Well, go ahead. Go ahead, Tammy. Psalms 121 4. Verse 4.
Behold, he who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep.
He does not slumber or sleep. And we mentioned last week that this slumber and sleep is the same meaning, okay, on that. We looked at the different ways, and there may be more ways than I mentioned, that the word sleep is used in the Bible. It's used concerning one's death. When Christ made the statement that Lazarus sleeps, having written that he had died. In Acts chapter 20, verse 9, it talks about the young man who fell asleep during the preaching of Paul, and he fell. So you have it that way, but it's also used in a figurative way concerning sleep. And we looked at some verses on that, that God never sleeps. He watches over us continually. In Psalms chapter 139, my own 11 and 12.
If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee. But the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee.
The psalmist says, indeed, the darkness shall not hide from you. And the night shall shine as day. The darkness and light are both alike. In other words, there's no darkness, there's no sleep with God. That he is continually awake, observing what goes on in his creation. God used sleep time, again, we looked at in certain instances, to appear to people. He appeared to Joseph in a dream. So he uses, as we sleep, God does not sleep, but he uses it during biblical times, that opportunity to reveal certain things to people. And the word in verse 4 here of Psalms that we read in Psalms means spiritual dullness or slothful or to be slack or a lack of watchfulness, of which God is none of these. God is never slack concerning his promise. He's never slothful. He's always watchful. And we look at Matthew chapter 24 and verse 42 when he says, Christ says there, watch therefore. So God is always watching. He never sleeps in that sense. He's never dull. No spiritual dullness in that. Proverbs chapter 6, we looked at briefly last week. Proverbs chapter 6, you can read verses 9 through 11. And we're pointing out verses that are the opposite of who God is or what God is, okay, as far as sleep, this figurative language that is used concerning God.
How long will you slumber, O slumber? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall your prophet, poverty come on you like a prowler, and your deep like an armed man.
These verses here are describing whom?
A lazy person,
okay? Or who is irresponsible, or who refuses to acknowledge the demands of life. God created man for what purpose? Well, to glorify him, to worship him, but what else? He placed him on earth to be busy in labor as far as the support of families and all, and of the church and the kingdom. So he placed him here. He said, a little sleep, a little slumber. This God is not this. God is not sluggish. God does not slumber. He is always awake. He sees what goes on, if you will, 24/7. 2 Peter 3 and verse 9, God is not slack concerning his promise. God was patient with Israel. We look through this, but God is always watchful. He never sleeps in that sense of the figurative language, not applying to a physical aspect of sleep. That God is long-suffering. Proverbs 15 and verse 3. Braden.
The eyes of the Lord are in every place, watching the evil and the good.
He watches the evil and the good when? All the time, okay? He never sleeps. We'll look at some this morning. One of the things Israel did in captivity, the prayer to God that he would deliver them, even though it was foretold of the 70 years that they were spending in captivity, they still prayed for deliverance from the persecution that they were undergoing during this time. And I read an interesting story that I had popped up on YouTube. Said, I read of an infidel who once remarked, "I did not pray, attend church, read the Bible, help my neighbor, nor do any of the things which my friend on the next farm has been doing all the years, yet I have gained as much grain in my barn as he." To which the Christian neighbor replied, "God does not square all his accounts in October." So God's long-suffering. But God's going to square all accounts. It may not be in the time that we think he should, as Israel prayed, but God did square that account. And so it's something that we need to learn. Then we'll pick up with God sometimes sleeps. Psalms 44 and verse 23, maybe. On this, when the psalmist says, "Awake, why do you sleep, O Lord, arise, do not cast us off." Looking at this chapter, excuse me, this chapter is divided into three parts, okay? So again, we've all often stressed, we need to get the context of a verse to find out what the writer is having reference to. When you go back to chapter 3, verses 3 through 7. He's dealing, the psalmist is here dealing of what took place during the time of Israel, how that he drove out the nations as they went into Canaan. He talks about in verse 2, "You drove out the nations with your hand, and then you planted them, you afflicted the people and cast them out. For they did not gain possession of the land by their own accord," talking about Israel, "nor did they their own arms save them. But it's your right hand." So it's having reference, these verses are, when they went into Canaan, it was God who fought for them, who drove the inhabitants out. In verse 7, "But you have saved us from our enemies and have put to shame those who hated us." In verse 9, it starts a different thought. "But you have cast us off and put us to shame. You do not let us go with our armies. You make us turn back from the enemies and those who hate us have taken spoil for themselves. You have given us up like sheep for food." In other words, because of their disobedience after God gave them the land of Canaan, they became disobedient. So you have this 70 years of captivity that takes place. He says, "You've cast us off. You've given us up like sheep. You scattered us among the nations." The second part of thought to this chapter. Verse 17. "All this has come upon us, but we have not forgiven you." During the time of captivity, the people of Israel said, "We still, Lord, because you've given us up, have not forgotten you. Oh, stretch out our hands to a, or have stretched out our hands to a foreign God. Would not God search this out? For he knows the secrets of the heart. Yet for your sake, we are killed all day. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter." Then the psalmist says, "Awake, O Lord." What are they asking for? For one, God has not forgotten them, has he? He gave them a time period of 70 years. But what is their prayer?
Why do you wait?
"Awake, O Lord, out of your sleep," out of your, if you will, your slumber, "and deliver us." Again, it's used in a figurative way. that God was not sleeping. They're just asking for deliverance. Awake from your sleep. Why do you sleep, O Lord? Arise, do not cast us off. Why do you hide your face and forget our afflictions? Well, God had not hidden his face. God had not forgotten their afflictions. God had placed a time period upon them. And at that time, did not God deliver them? Of course, what would be your prayers during times of afflictions? We have to understand, God does things on his timetable. He does not do on our timetable what we want. As Paul once prayed on his thorn. God does not do things as man would want them to be done. God knew their condition. He knew what they were going through. Why, we're not told at this time, other than the 70 years, that he'd not deliver them. But again, God works all things for those who love him. Romans 8, verse 28. As we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, for those who are called according to his purpose. This may include persecutions or afflictions or whatever, that God works these things for our benefit. Yes, Bella.
Sometimes what we think is good for us may not be good for us. God sees that, you know. He knows what's good for us better than we know.
True. And again, with that thought, suffering should produce what in us? We're told by the Scripture that we're going to suffer in this life. We understand that ahead of time. But yet, during this time of suffering, do we not pray to God that this suffering cease? That's the human nature you're going to. Or the suffering of a child. In Romans chapter 8, down verse 18,
for I consider that the suffering of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is going to be revealed to us.
Paul making this statement, and I would doubt seriously, they may be men that suffered any more than what Paul did in his life. But Paul makes a statement here, he counts this suffering of this present time are not worthy to be what God's going to will be in eternity. It's for a short time. Even in being put to death, Christ stood upon the cross. His suffering was for a short time.
Even he prayed that it would be his will.
This is human nature. That's what we do, our design, if you will, on that. But that lasts for a short time. Punishment in hell lasts in eternity. And so, that Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 10, Ethan.
For it is fitting for him who, for whom all things and through whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to perfect the author for their salvation through sufferings.
But they meant to make the captain of their salvation perfect through suffering. If Christ suffered, we as his followers likewise are going to suffer. But he's our captain. That we look to him for what? Enduring these sufferings much as he did. Hebrews 5 verse 9, though he were a son, yet learned he the obedience by the things that he suffered. So God does not sleep. He understands what we go through. He understands our sufferings, okay? If he at the time does not choose to deliver us from those sufferings, don't mean he does not know or he does not see. And so again, these three ways in which the word sleep, as far as death, a physical sleep, and a figurative sense concerning God. Any thoughts? Is God eternal? Psalms 9 in verse 2, Jacob.
Everlasting
means what? no beginning, no end, okay? An indefinite start to an indefinite ending, okay? There's no start, no end of the future. Any thoughts of why that he mentioned in this verse, before the mountains were brought forth, I think your version, Jacob read what, was born?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that phrase?
I guess before he created us.
I don't have much need, but in Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 15, I think the point that he's trying to get across of how people view the mountains during this time, it says in verse 15, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the precious things of the everlasting hills. And we know that they were not everlasting, but it has mentioned that they were of old, they were ancient. And I think what the psalmist said, even before this, God was. There's a reference that he's had in making on that. Anybody have any thoughts on that? Psalms 93 and verse 2, next in line. Your throne is established from old. You are from everlasting. That God is eternal. Again, I think we understand that. Okay? Any thoughts on God is everlasting or God is eternal?
It's just kind of hard to picture in my mind anyway, something that you think everything has a beginning. So it makes you wonder how, just always was, but in human mind, I think everything has a beginning, but it don't necessarily.
Yeah, I think that we fail to grasp because we are limited. You know, even the smartest man that ever lived in the world, it won't be an Einstein, his knowledge is also limited. In comparison to God, there's no comparison in that. So it's something that the way we're made, we deal with it a little bit when it talks about that God is spirit and we must worship Him in spirit and truth. It's having real, sir, there's nothing physical about us that we can worship God with. Period. It must be with the eternal spirit that is within us that we worship God. It has nothing to do physically that we do, that we can worship God. We'll look at that as we get to it. His origin in time. In other words, the atheists or the doubters are saying, well, yeah, I know the scriptures say that God's eternal, but the book of Habakkuk says that He has an origin. And again, his misrepresentation of scripture, if you will. Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 3. Yeah. Right. Habakkuk 3 and verse 3.
God came down from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran.
Right, God came down from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. There's some versions you've got says, that the Lord will come from Teman.
The King James Version says God came from
Teman. Okay. I read one version that it used that God will come from Teman. I don't know whether any of your versions mention that or not. Any thoughts on this verse as far as God is eternal, God has an origin?
I don't know that if you put it in context that it's actually speaking about an origin of God, number one.
Yeah.
And number two, we know from John 1:30, that nothing was ever created or even in existence without Him. So,
when you look, I don't know if people look at the location of, again, most of your, or all of them, to some degree more than others, of the Old Testament prophets, the major and the minor prophets, use a lot of figurative language in their writings. And we understand that. I don't know if anyone looked at the location of where, at this time, of the writings, where were the children of Israel? Were they in captivity? Where were they in captivity at? No? They had treacherous God's law, and God gave them to captivity. A great nation came and captured them. Who was it? Right, you had Babylon. Okay, you had these nations, okay, that came and captured. If you look at location on a map, in where Teman is compared to where Babylon is. Now, these are just my thoughts. I'm not saying that's right, okay? It's to the east Babylon is to the east of Teman, okay? And the thoughts on that God would come from Teman, that God would deliver his people. Of course, in the east is where the sun comes up from, is it not? This bright light that shines every morning that the clouds do not take it away from us. We see that every morning that God could come from to deliver his people from the direction of the sun. Again, it has reference to his manifestation. Children of Israel were, they're in captivity at this time. So where does God come from to deliver them? Okay? So he comes from that as a light, this great manifestation that God is going to deliver his people. You have other verses that use similar languages. Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verse 2, Lord. And I was having reference to, again, this video, is to God's judgment, that God is coming to do something, okay? Deuteronomy 33 and verse 2. He came from Mount Sinai, okay, or he came from Sinai. He dawned on them from where? Seir. He shone forth from where? This manifestation from Mount Paran. Okay, it has reference with his judgment. Or maybe the application here is as far as the Ten Commandments that God came, okay, from Sinai or to Sinai. And so it's used, if you will, in different ways. Judges 5 and verse 4, Lord. Judges 5 and verse 4.
Lord, when thou wentest out of Seir, when thou marchest out of the field of Eden, the earth trembled and the heavens dropped, the clouds also dropped water.
Okay, he went out from Seir. He was at Seir. He went out from Seir for what purpose? When you marched on the field of Eden, the earth trembled and the heavens poured. For judgment, okay, to bring judgment on the people. So when he came from Teman, he came for what purpose? Again, this judgment upon the people there. Again, it's just a figure of speech. It means judgment. He came from a place to render judgment. His manifestation, this brightness of his glory there. Any thoughts anyone have on that? Does God have a material body? Tish? Luke 24 and verse 39.
Do my hands and my feet, and it is I myself, touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have.
Now God, Christ here is asking those apostles that he is assembled with after his resurrection to touch him physically, okay? But because the Son of Man, when you look at John 1, verse 14, I think Mark kind of alluded to, but John 1, verse 14, And it talks about, and the Word became flesh, that is Christ, and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So Christ became flesh, that He may be as His brethren. So He's telling His disciples here, touch me, feel that I am still in this physical body. But God the Father does not have a physical body like us, even though Christ took upon this body. He's real among us. But that does not mean that God the Father does not have a body. Okay? He does. Because 1 Corinthians 15 tells us why He's going to give us a body as He is. And so He has a body. It's just not the physical aspect to it. 1 Corinthians 15. Let's read verses 42 through 44.
So also is the resurrection of the dead. The body is sown in corruption, it is raised in corruption. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown in natural body, it is raised in spiritual body. There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body.
Okay. And so a body, a spirit has a body, okay, or is going to have a body. God has a body now of what Moses asked to see and was not able to see, the glory that was in the body in which God was. When you look at verse 46, however, the spiritual is not the first, but the natural, and afterwards, the spiritual. So each has a body. It's something that we see, that we can look at another, that see each other's body, their form. But we cannot see the spiritual aspect to mankind. But it will eventually have, if you will, a body. Verse 49. As we have been born in the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the heavenly man. That God's going to give us a body. Such as He is. That will live through eternity. And so God does not have a material body, but He does have a body. That we're going to be conformed to who He is. In Luke, that we understand this God is spirit, this body that He has. That God has attributes in this spiritual body, does He not? He's a spirit. He has attributes. In eternity, in our spiritual body, will we have attributes? Well, Lazarus. Go ahead, Larry.
I would say, no, we would not have attributes. Attribute is something that is part of your inherent nature that you have. It's your essence. I feel that we would end up having the characteristics that God would give to us. But if we don't have those attributes now, we develop those characteristics. So, in the spiritual body that gives us, we will have the characteristics of His attribute or His essence.
I mentioned the thought of Lazarus when he lifted up his eyes and knew the pain and suffering that he was in and the remembrance of his brethren on earth. From that aspect, he wasn't in the physical aspect this time, but the spiritual aspect in Hades, in hell. Not the final place, but that just kind of a thought that occurred to me, and I agree with you on that. Any other thoughts on that? Does God have material, or God is a spirit? God has a material body, and again, they just master, if you will, verses, okay? Exodus chapter 31, verse 18. Jan?
And he gave unto Moses, when he had made an end of the news of him upon Mount Sinai, two tables of testimony, tables of stone, written with the finger of God.
I can take this phrase, written with the finger of God, and make the application that God has a literal finger, like five in the thumb on each hand that we have. Again, this is what they say is a contradiction. What it says in spirit here, now he's got this physical form, if you will. Let's look at some other verses. So, Exodus chapter 8. Gregory, verses 16 through 20.
So the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land. Let it come blast throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so. For Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and struck the dust of the earth. It became lice on man and beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt. The magicians so worked with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there were lice on man and beast. And the magicians said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. But Pharaoh's heart grew hard. He did not heed them, just as the Lord had said. The Lord said to Moses, rise early in the morning, and stand before Pharaoh as he comes out of the water, and say to him, thus says the Lord, let my people go, that they may serve me.
Okay, the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. They were having reference to what? This or what?
His power.
His power, okay? In the writing of the Ten Commandments, talk about it was wrote with the finger of God. By his power. We're not told how he done that, but we know that he literally did not take a pen and paper out and write something. On that, Psalms 8 and verse 3. You want to read that? Psalms 8, verse 3.
8, verse 3.
Yeah. Psalms 8, verse 3, yes.
When I consider the heavens, the work of the fingers, the moon, the stars, which thou hast
created. When I consider the heavens, which was the work of your fingers. Okay? Again, showing God's power to create. Okay? It's all having reference. And we'll close with Luke chapter 11 and verse 20. Whoever's next in line to read. Luke 11 and verse 20. Alright.
But if I cast out demons by the finger of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you.
Okay, and I think you can see in all these phrases that it's used, the finger of God, it's just simply having reference to his power, what he can do.
It's like saying by the hand of God.
Yeah. I don't know if ever, I'm not a mention for people have ever seen the movie Twister, and when they're talking about the different categories of tornadoes, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, and they ask what category 5 was, they refer to that's the finger of God. Have reference to the power of which that tornado was. Okay? And that's all this is having reference to. Yet, those doubters who want to say that the Bible contradicts itself take this completely out of context on that. Any thoughts from anyone? All right, Mark, before we start, the Lord's room will begin next Sunday morning. Thank you.